When the dark shadow at the gate withdrew, Gandalf still sat motionless, but Pippin rose to his feet, as if a great weight had been lifted from him, and he stood listening to the horns, and it seemed to him that they would break his heart with joy, and never in years after could he hear a horn blown in the distance without tears starting in his eyes. But now suddenly his errand returned to his memory, and he ran forward. At that moment Gandalf stirred and spoke to Shadowfax, and was about to ride through the gate. "Gandalf! Gandalf!" cried Pippin, and Shadowfax halted. "What are you doing here?" said Gandalf. "Is it not the law in the city that those who wear the black and silver must stay in the citadel unless their lord gives them leave?" "He has," said Pippin. "He sent me away, but I am frightened. Something terrible may happen up there. The lord is out of his mind, I think. I am afraid he will kill himself, and kill Faramir too. Can't you do something?" Clifford, we're back again.
Indeed we are.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. This might be our first like kind of proper intro for a while, because we didn't do it for the other ones, because we just jumped straight in. Mm-hmm, like, you mm-hmm. know, we were all about it, and they were really long episodes.
So. We finally caught our breath.
yeah, a little bit. You know, this one started off a little hot. That was, just FYI, everybody, that was my epic reading for the night. That's what I'm submitting. Though I have an out-of-the-box one that could be a second candidate, but... Okay. I'm not going to reveal it.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, that's my submission. We'll see how Clifford does later. I have no idea what he picked. But yeah, how you doing, Clifford?
I'm doing well. Recovering from some poison oak. So my arms and legs are mildly on fire, but that's thematically... Yeah. Thematically inspired for this chapter.
Hey, no spoilers!
How are you doing, Patrick?
I'm doing good. So this is, like, especially pertaining to the chapter, I'm really pumped for tonight, all right? So it cuts both ways, though. So when I was reading this chapter, I was also really on fire about, you know, thinking of things to talk about myself, you know, and not having to rely on supplementary stuff and everything. And mm-hmm. so, like, I went to all my sources afterwards that, you know, sometimes they're often I use that to, like, strum up, like, ideas of stuff to talk about that would be relevant. And I was very surprised. They had all sorts of different ideas I didn't think of. And mm-hmm. so it's like, oh, shoot. For such a short chapter, this might be a big episode.
Okay.
That said, honestly, we could potentially make this one shorter, but I feel I have solid reasoning why we shouldn't. So if you're looking at how short the chapter is and how long our episode will be, just FYI, this is like not dumb, and we'll try not to get too into the weeds of stuff. We'll try to stay on topic, you know. That said, do you have much Cliff notes for this one?
I do have a few. I have a short chapter, as you mentioned, so, or at least plot wise. So
yeah.
I'll do this real quick. So, after the Black Rider leaves the gates of Gondor, Pippin warns Gandalf that Denethor intends to burn Faramir alive. Reluctantly, Gandalf abandons the army to go save Faramir. They find an enraged Denethor preparing to light a funeral pyre for himself and Faramir. Gandalf rescues Faramir, and Denethor burns himself alive.
All right. Okay, so, yeah, let's jump into it here. We heard the opening, too, where, you know, Pippin... All right, this honestly, the first page is like the only time we get to talk about Pippin, because I mean, honestly, like, you know, Pippin's the one that's going to initiate Gandalf to go up there and save Faramir, mm-hmm. but like other than that, I mean, I don't know, he's just completely overshadowed by Gandalf for the rest of the chapter, even though it's kind of like third person slightly from Pippin's point of view, I guess, you mm-hmm. know, but
notably though, he's the spark of the chapter.
Right. Right?
He kicks off every... Sorry, I don't mean to make keep making fire puns. But he sets everything
We're
going
to try to make as many fire references as we can tonight.
Pippin sparks the action at the start of the chapter that's, yeah. that's crucial for what happens later. So
he's like the flint. And you, the flint is very important. Even Bear Grylls can tell you
uh-huh,
that.
Uh-huh.
Right. So... All right, so yeah, should we jump in a little bit where he talks to Gandalf? Because he tells him, like, hey, I mean, Denethor is planning to burn him alive. And then what does Gandalf say there?
Burn him alive, said Gandalf. What is this tale? Be quick.
Denethor has gone to the tomb, said Pippin, and he has taken Faramir, and he says we are all to burn, and he will not wait. And they are to make a pyre and burn him on it, and Faramir as well. And he has sent men to fetch wood and oil. And I have told Baragond, but I'm afraid he won't dare to leave his post. He is on guard. And what can he do anyways? So Pippin poured out his tale, reaching up and touching Gandalf's knee with trembling hands. Can't you save Faramir?
Maybe I can, said Gandalf. But if I do, then others will die, I fear. Well, I must come, since no other help can reach him. But evil and sorrow will come of this. Even in the heart of our stronghold, the enemy has power to strike us. For his will it is that this is at work.
Okay, so immediately... lot there, and that's gonna be the theme of every single thing that we read tonight. It's like, whoa, this is just packed. All right, mm-hmm. Very dense. Okay,
immediately,
so,
Gandalf is presented with a total moral dilemma. Right.
Right. Yep. Instantly.
This is like,
and what is that dilemma?
You could read into it more that it's like just like some like textbook moral problem. Like, do you save one person right now or many later? How do you even know? Mm. But basically, it's he thinks he can save the day in one of two cases, either trying to save Faramir or go fight the Black Rider on the field before he totally wreaks havoc on the invading Riders of Rohan.
Yeah, and his only reasoning why he's going to end up going to help Faramir is because, well, I'm the closest in range. I mean, nobody else can help him right,
right.
now. Right.
Whereas maybe somebody could, miraculously pull something off on the battlefield.
Right. And yeah, like you're saying, if he goes up there, others down here will die, right? Mm-hmm. That he, so not even Gandalf. Gandalf's so powerful. He's one of these like really powerful figures in this whole book and everything. And no, not even he can completely save the day here, right?
Right.
Even he's kind of in a spot. And if we remember from the last chapter, from Merry's perspective, he was asking, like, where's Gandalf? If he was here, maybe he could save Théoden, right?
Right.
And in fact, that's one of the... I mean, there was a lot going on in the last chapter, but it wasn't glaring because there was so much going on, but one of the loose ends of that chapter was, where's Gandalf? I mean, the Prince Imrahil was there, but Gandalf wasn't, right?
And now we're finding out.
Yeah. All right. Then the coolest part, in my opinion, Gandalf, because he's so wise, is instantly aware this evil is directly from Sauron himself somehow, because he says, even in the heart of our own stronghold, the enemy has power to strike us, right? Okay, and so let's take that beyond the context of Lord of the Rings and beyond the context of just a broad city, good city, right? Isn't this true for every single person, like in our hearts as well?
What do you mean?
Even in the heart of our stronghold, the enemy has power to strike us. So even if you're the best guy in the world, can't you have the possibility for evil and everything, right?
Okay.
You get it?
Yeah.
So apply that, you take that from this whole Gondor city level down to just a single person, and most literary scholars will say that is the biggest ingredient needed to have a top echelon kind of story, right?
Okay.
It's not just a struggle with evil on the outside, but it's the struggle with evil from within.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what really sets up a recipe for a really good story. On a individual character level, where have we already seen that in Lord of the Rings?
Well, probably a couple of examples. One that comes to mind immediately is Boromir. We talked about his personal struggle with doing the right thing versus what he wants to do versus kind of being corrupted by the power of the ring.
Yep.
And then...
Oh, there's a lot. Come on, dude.
I know. I mean, I'm trying to think of one where it's really kind of evil. A lot of other characters have faced kind of temptation or internal struggle. Frodo,
yeah.
Sam, Gandalf himself. Maybe we could say Aragorn.
Well, so, you know, there's a bunch of characters that struggle with the ring, but it's like, you know, to a certain extent, sure, the ring has, like, overt power.
Right,
you know,
right.
And, like, almost like a radius kind of thing. But, like, still, it is still, in essence, it's kind of still within the character anyways, too.
Right,
or
right.
Solely in the character, really. You know, and so by that logic, it's like, well, Bilbo in the first chapter, remember, right, it was like, definitely. That was hard for him to give up the ring. Frodo, we've seen that throughout. Gollum's probably the most obvious one, you know, cause especially after reading all of book four.
Mm-hmm.
And then another really good one was Galadriel when Frodo even offered to give her the ring and everything. You know?
Yeah, so it's kind of, it's like an external trigger for an internal conflict.
Right, right. Yep. Okay, so then the very next line that he has here is, then having made up his mind, he acted swiftly. And this being Gandalf. So it's like, ah, now that is a, you know, common quality of a good leader. Once the choice is made, no more second guessing, even if, you know, people's lives hang in the balance either way. It's like, we got to commit, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
one brief thing to add with this is, like, kind of applies to both of these, is that Gandalf, you can see that he's powerful and wise, but he's not omnipotent and he's not omniscient. Like he's,
oh, yeah.
Which I think is a super critical bit here as we're thinking about, like, what, how much can Gandalf save the day? It's like he might be the most godlike of the characters we read about in Lord of the Rings or kind of follow directly, but he's still way more on the spectrum of, like, relatable to human experience and having these dilemmas and challenges, and he can only be in one place at once, even if he is powerful. Whereas, you know, if he was omnipotent or something, he could be fighting the Black Rider and saving Faramir at the same time. Like, he would already know these things. He wouldn't be having realizations or doubts or anything like that. So anyway, or even making decisions, really, to take it to the next level. So keep going.
Let's see. So, all right. So Gandalf and Pippin, they're riding up to the top of the city on Shadowfax. They pass Prince Imrahil. Gandalf gives him command. Okay, so then the next thing, they find the porter. Okay, I thought porters were the guys that carry bags, but this made it imply he was, like, the door warden.
Because
he's dead and his key is taken.
Mm-hmm.
All right, but I'm not crazy. He carries bags, right? That's what I always thought. Porter, portage.
Yeah.
You know, like...
I think maybe the title could refer to, like, doorman in the abstract.
I'm sure Tolkien was wrong. All right, and what does Gandalf say when he sees him dead? Work of the enemy, such deeds he loves. Friend at war with friend, loyalty divided and confusion of hearts. All right, so, you know, if you read anything in, like, history or study anything, like, even semi-decently, what you'll quickly see is, like, civil wars or civil strife is just, like, the worst thing in the world. Like, it's just depressing. Like, I honestly don't understand the people that love studying Civil War stuff. You know, World War II, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
Civil War, I don't.
it's so brutal.
It's just depressing. And, you know, like, the casualty counts, it's like, all right, well, the Civil War had, like, the worst casualty rate because, you know, both sides were American, right? You know, for American losses, it is. But, yeah, I mean, it's like, ugh. Fleming Rutledge points out guard-on-guard killing. That's an example of moral anarchy. That always occurs in the absence of wise leadership. Because, you know, Denethor, he has not been the most wise and fearless of leaders of late. Gandalf dismounts from Shadowfax. They go to the Rath Dinin, which is the tomb place, you know, so they're outside the chamber that Denethor's in.
Wait, can I derail you real quick?
When
Gandalf, when he hops off Shadowfax, he like turns to Shadowfax and he says, "For my friend," he said, "you and I should have ridden to the fields long ago, but other matters delay me. Yet come swiftly if I call." Did you read that as, like, we should have ridden out to the battlefield, but I'm busy? Because I feel like it kind of sounds like a random offhanded comment, like, Shadowfax, my good horse. Like, we should have retired a while back, but, you know, duty calls.
Oh, no, I think it's to the battle. Okay. But then, you know, like, the clunky language here, it's just like, again, this goes back to that thing where it's like, all right. Nobody would actually say this on a battlefield.
Yeah.
Like, you read the Iliad, and it's like, Achilles did not say this.
Right.
Like, this wasn't as poetic as, you know, if it ever existed, which is very far-fetched, but of course I believe it.
Right.
You know, it's like, it was not this poetic, right?
Uh-huh.
You know? So that's kind of what I just assume that one is.
Uh-huh. Okay. Sorry. Keep going.
Oh, well, no, no, no. We're gonna jump in here and, you know, we're going to take breaks, but we're going to read a lot of this central conflict, I think. Potentially all of it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're Gandalf, so you want to start us off? Stay, stay.
Stay, stay, cried Gandalf, springing forward to the stone stair before the door. Stay this madness. For there were the servants of Denethor with swords and torches in their hands, but alone in the porch upon the topmost step stood Barragond, clad in the black and silver of the guard, and he held the door against them. Two of them had already fallen to his sword, staining the hollows with their blood, and the others cursed him, calling him outlaw and traitor to his master.
Even as Gandalf and Pippin ran forward, they heard from within the House of the Dead the voice of Denethor crying, "Haste, haste! Do as I have bidden! Slay me this renegade, or must I do so myself?" Thereupon, the door which Barragond held shut with his left hand was wrenched open, and there behind him stood the lord of the city, tall and fell, a light like a flame in his eyes, and he held a drawn sword.
But Gandalf sprang up the steps, and the men fell back from him and covered their eyes, for his coming was like the incoming of a white light into a dark place, and he came with great anger. He lifted up his hand, and in the very stroke the sword of Denethor flew up and left his grasp, and fell behind him in the shadows of the house. And Denethor stepped backward before Gandalf as one amazed. "What is this, my lord?" said the wizard. "The houses of the dead are no places for the living. And why do men fight here in the hallows when there is war enough before the gate? Or has our enemy come even to Rath Dinan?"
"Since when has the lord of Gondor been answerable to thee?" said Denethor. "Or may I not command my own servants?"
"You may," said Gandalf, "but others may contest your will when it is turned to madness and evil. Where is your son, Faramir?"
"He lies within," said Denethor, "burning, already burning. They have set a fire in his flesh. But soon all shall be burned. The west has failed. It shall all go up in a great fire, and all shall be ended. Ash, ash and smoke, blown away on the wind." All right. So, that was big. Mm-hmm. Potentially, Faramir is already dying. So. All right, thoughts on that first? Because I got a ton, and I'm just going to always have a ton as soon as we stop.
Well, I'd say this is probably like the final culmination of the tension. Ever since Gandalf walked in the door, we've known there's tension between Denethor and Gandalf, right? Like,
right.
Choice words, like just a little bit awkward,
A good point. That's a good point. I didn't even think to bring that up. That's the whole thing with this. I think there's so much going on here like that, you know, you forget to bring stuff up. But yeah, go on.
It's all out now. Like, Denethor has literally drawn a sword against Gandalf, called him out, and Gandalf is now kind of expressing more of his true power to put Denethor in his place, because he's like, you finally stepped out of line entirely. You're not just pushing the boundaries of what you're supposed to be doing.
Right, right.
And I thought really important, though, that Gandalf is he provides this quick justification. "But others may contest your will when it is turned to madness and evil," which I thought was like,
I love that too.
That's some like good little politics in there, kind of like, this is not a coup. I'm not deposing you because you don't have a right to the throne. It's more like you've proved that you're not fit to serve anymore.
Correct.
Therefore, I'm taking it. I'm like doing the service of the people, kind of, and expressing that. So he justifies himself on Denethor's terms, not on his own, like, "I'm Gandalf, I'm powerful, and you're doing the wrong thing."
Yep, absolutely. The other thing I would say too is, you know, Gandalf, he comments on how the Gondor soldiers are killing each other, which is ridiculous considering the battle that's going outside the city walls, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, absolutely very good for Barragond here. We got to shout him out. Not just following orders like the other guards, you know, mm-hmm. and like that's kind of a famous phrase, like just following orders, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the most famous offenders of just following orders probably lived in Tolkien's lifetime in Nazi Germany, Soviet Russia, China. I mean, you know, it's like, I don't know, like the list can go on and stuff, but it's like, yeah, okay. So, you know, the just following order stuff is pretty bad. And just to contrast too, I believe we pointed out this would not have flown in Rohan, right? If we remember there, the door wards there, like they were notably thinking for themselves. Like, right. They were just like, Gandalf, I trust you. You know, I think you know what's best for the king. I'm going to let you in, even though I'm clearly not supposed to let you in with any staff. It was an explicit order, but I'm just going to disregard it, you know? Right.
Blatant disobedience for Wormtongue.
Right. You know, so it's like, all right, well, so we're seeing these contrasts here. Like, some of these Gondor soldiers are dumb enough to just follow the orders, even when it says, yeah, kill your king. Right, mm-hmm. Kill your steward. Okay, so it does sound like Faramir's already burning up at the end there. So let's jump in, let's see what's going on. So why don't you take it, because you're Gandalf.
Then Gandalf, seeing the madness that was on him, feared that he had already done some evil deed, and he thrust forward with Baragond and Pippin behind him, while Denethor gave back until he stood beside the table within. But there they found Faramir, still dreaming in his fever, lying upon the table. Wood was piled under it, and high all about it, all was drenched with oil, even the garments of Faramir and the coverlets. But as yet no fire had been set to the fuel. Then Gandalf revealed the strength that lay hid in him, and even as the light of his power was hidden under his great mantle. He leaped up onto the faggots, and raising the sick man lightly, he sprang down again and bore him towards the door. But as he did so, Faramir moaned and called on his father in his dream.
Denethor started as one waking from a trance, and the flame died in his eyes, and he wept, and he said, "Do not take my son from me. He calls for me."
"He calls," said Gandalf, "but you cannot come to him yet, for he must seek healing on the threshold of death, and maybe find it not. Whereas your part is to go out to the battle of your city, where maybe death awaits you. This you know in your heart."
"He will not wake again," said Denethor. "Battle is vain. Why should we wish to live longer? Why should we not go to death side by side?"
"Authority is not given to you, steward of Gondor, to order the hour of your death," answered Gandalf. "And only the heathen kings, under the domination of the dark power, did thus, slaying themselves in pride and despair, murdering their kin to ease their own death."
All right, so another massive section. Okay, you start us off. You start us off before I just go off.
Okay, so thankfully Faramir not actually dead yet, but here's where I think Gandalf expands upon the. He's continuing the culmination, the call out of Denethor, but it's taken on a new tone now. It's not just Denethor, you're crazy, you don't have a right to give orders anymore. Now it's like enumerating how Denethor is failing at his position, and very specific, well, let me think about how to phrase this best.
Sure.
Gandalf is giving Denethor almost a directive, almost an order.
Yep.
But we can imagine piercing right to the middle of like Denethor's own self-doubt. His own self-consciousness here. What Denethor knows that he's supposed to be doing, which is leading his city in battle. And then the second bit, I think, is like a whole nother question of morality. But he basically is saying, not only are you like failing to fulfill your role, Denethor, but the idea that you would commit a ceremonial suicide is like totally coward. And you can't even do it. You're not even allowed to do this.
Right.
Is the heathen kings only can do ceremonial suicide.
And that's, well, all right, you go on, finish your thought. Yeah.
It's basically like that he's pretty much calling out Denethor as like the idea of doing this is just fundamentally immoral. Faramir aside, just the idea of sacrificing yourself in this time of need is like shame and cowardice.
All right, yeah, so I agree with, like, all that. Like, especially just to start off, I mean, yeah, Gandalf brings up, he's like, I mean, maybe you will see Faramir again, but, you know, first, you gotta go, you know, defend your city, go to the battle, you know, help out, right? Like, that's what you're supposed to do, right? This is your duty to heroically lead your people, right? But Denethor, I mean, he thinks it's hopeless, you know, and you can start comparing that to, what other old leader of free men is fighting at this very moment?
Théoden, right?
Yeah, Théoden, right. So Théoden's down there, you know, he's probably similar age, you know, he's out there fighting, you know, and what's he showing? He's showing that ferocious northern courage, you know, like, even if it's everything's lost, like Ragnarok bad, impossible odds to win, still we're gonna go down fighting, you know, like I marched here for days and days, Éomer, he's not thrilled either, you know, but we're here, we're gonna do this because this is our duty, right? We're supposed to answer Gondor's call, we always will because we're Rohan and we're awesome, right? You know, versus Denethor, who's now like almost becoming like a nihilist, right? You know, battle's vain, why should we wish to live longer, why not just go die now side by side, right? Like all of it's kind of pointless, you know, and this is gonna get worse. But then, as you were bringing up, here's a question. The word authority comes at the beginning of the sentence, so obviously capitalize it. But there's like a slight chance that like you might just capitalize authority anyways. like as in like whose authority are we talking about here? Like Gandalf is almost implying like, Denethor, you are not allowed to commit suicide like this, or you're not allowed to commit suicide yourself, or even better, just plainly, Denethor, your life's not about you, period. Which, and you know, like all of that sounds very Christian, period. But then on top of that too is like, dude, you're the leader of this kingdom. This is like the kingdom that stands against Sauron, and that comes with demanding responsibilities and duties that have been entrusted to you. Like, you get this, you know this. You cannot just be shirking it this badly. Like, you are just completely failing in this attempt, right? Fleming Rutledge, what did she say? She says, there can be no running away from the responsibility that comes with authority. When such a vacuum occurs, there is room for every sort of poison to spread, you know? And so it's like, all right, even here in the heart of the kingdom, right? Of this, the good kingdom that defends the whole West, you know, it's like, this is what's happening. Tom Shippey kind of points out too, like the reference to the suicide and like heathen kings and stuff. Well, that is actually kind of like the flip side of the coin to the heroic pagan, like Northern courage and stuff. It's like, I don't know. When you get into it, when you just start digging under the surface, it's like human sacrifice, ritual suicide, those kinds of things were common or even the norm in all sorts of ancient pagan cultures. And so it's like, I don't know. Tolkien was taking the best with like the highlighting the northern courage of these people, you know, that he loves so much, like the Anglo-Saxons and the Norse people and everything. But then it's also like he's not, you know, he's not trying to idolize them. Like he understands, like, no, their bad side was bad. like, you know, the human sacrifice part that was part of the culture, that's just bad, and he doesn't miss that whatsoever, right? Because he says the greatest contribution they made was their northern courage. It's like, I don't know, everybody has their faults and stuff, so he was aware of that, even if he doesn't highlight as much as the good part, right?
Right. Then, passing through the door, he took Faramir from the deadly house and lay him on the bier on which he had been brought, and which had now been set on the porch. Denethor followed him and stood trembling, looking with longing on the face of his son. And for a moment, while all were silent and still, watching the Lord in his throes, he wavered. "Come," said Gandalf, "we are needed. There is much that you can do yet."
Then suddenly Denethor laughed. He stood up tall and proud again, and stepping swiftly back to the table, he lifted from it the pillow on which his head had lain. Then, coming to the doorway, he drew aside the covering, and lo, he had between his hands a palantir. And as he held it up, it seemed to those that looked on that the globe began to glow with an inner flame, so that the lean face of the Lord was lit as with red fire, and it seemed cut out of hard stone, sharp with black shadows, noble, proud, and terrible. His eyes glittered. "Pride and despair," he cried. "Didst thou think that the eyes of the White Tower were blind? Nay, I have seen more than thou knowest, gray fool, for thy hope is but ignorance. Go then, and labor in healing. Go forth and fight. Vanity. For a little space you may triumph on the field, for a day. But against the power that now arises, there is no victory. To this city only, the first finger of its hand has yet been stretched. All the east is moving. And even now, the wind of thy hope cheats thee, and wafts up Anduin, a fleet with black sails. The west has failed. It is time for all to depart who would not be slaves." All right, another massive section. All right, so it's the plant here, right? That's that's what we're saying. Why don't you lead it off, though? You give your thoughts.
Not that we needed any twists here, but Denethor reveals reveals a Palantir, which in our, I think all of our experience so far has always gone poorly. If a Palantir shows up in the scene, it's usually not a good thing.
Pippin, it went badly, but like it somehow worked for good luck by Providence, basically.
right. But, fair enough.
But yeah.
I guess, and then Aragorn.
Aragorn was ballsy and knew he could do it.
Right.
And he used it for good ends.
Right. We heard about it only after the fact, though, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't like a brandishing of a Palantir. Point being, right. Yeah. it's a total twist that Dumbledore has one.
All right, where did he get it?
Wasn't there one in Gondor for a very long time? All the way back from Numenor?
Well, yeah, so the seven came from Numenor, three were up north, one was in Asgiliath, and I believe it was lost, like just destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
One was in Minas Morgul, which is the one that Sauron has,
mm-hmm.
and then one was always in Minas Tirith, so... You know, Denethor's just using that one. That's all it is, you know. And then there was one in Isengard, and that was the one that Saruman was just always using. You know?
Gotcha. Okay.
Of course, he wasn't always using it. Both him and Denethor, they weren't always using it. They just always had it.
Right. They followed a similar path, right?
That right. We saw. Well, yeah, that's what's becoming clear.
They were wise enough to avoid it, and then at some point grew powerful, thought that they were powerful, but...
Yeah,
we're actually foolish enough to start to use it, and
right, so that
went downhill from there.
Yeah, so that's the key there. Yeah, yeah, they thought they were powerful to use it. I mean, like the Palantir. It's like we actually compared it to when we were talking about it with Saruman. We actually compared it to TV and propaganda, because Palantir literally means television, like far seeing television, far seeing. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, man, that's. The knowledge that goes with it, because that's why you use it to gain more knowledge and stuff, is like hell of a drug here, you know?
Yeah.
It's pretty bad, right?
But, okay, pre-Palantir, though, one quick thing I want to touch on.
Yeah, because then we're going to get into this more, too.
Gandalf, so right where we pick up, they start walking out of the room. Gandalf basically gives Denethor carte blanche, like, is nearing on, like, full forgiveness. Maybe he's, like... called him out, so Denethor is like, you know, has his tail between his legs. Maybe he's officially deposed as steward, whatever. More could come. But he's basically saying, Denethor, stop doing what you're doing and get back to what you're supposed to be doing, and we can leave it at that, right? And they just start walking out as though Denethor legitimately has a chance right there to make amends and turn things around.
And he almost does. Like, he wavered is Denethor, you know, because he heard, like, the Faramir's voice calling out to him. Uh-huh. So he's like, oh, my son is kind of still alive, you know, like, I want to be with him, and maybe I should just do what I'm supposed to. We saw that, too, with what other character famously did that? Mm-hmm. Book four. There's only, like, four characters in book four, so you got
Gollum?
Yeah, Gollum did it, right? Because he saw Frodo and Sam peacefully sleeping right before they went into the tunnel, and he was like, oh... I could just be a good guy. And then Sam, like, woke up and then said, like, an insult, you know, and then Gollum's like, nah, screw him. and it was, like, totally accidental because it's not like Sam knew what he was doing.
Right,
but it's just like, ah, that's how it works, right?
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, so Denethor almost, I don't know, you're right. Denethor almost wavered here. Gandalf was just totally still always willing to work with him, right, as long as he's sensible, which he hasn't been for this chapter, nor really the end of the last chapter. Okay, let's go over, though. What did he see in this Palantir? What did Sauron show him? Because obviously that's what's going on. You know, it's like, it's just like how Sauron, when he controlled Saruman was seeing exactly what Sauron wanted him to see. And that's obviously going to be the same case with Denethor, who's even less powerful than Saruman, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what did Sauron show Denethor? It says a couple things there.
The implication is all of the armies of Mordor, right?
Well, specifically. All right, what did he see? Come on.
Okay.
What happened in the last chapter?
The fleet on the Anduin.
Yeah, okay. So the fleet's coming up. Right. Because at this point in the timeline, we're behind where last chapter ended, right? Obviously, you know. Mm-hmm. Like Théoden's out there doing battle right now, and Okay, so the fleet's coming up, which Gandalf and Rohan have not accounted for, then what you're saying too, he shows all the might of Mordor that hasn't even come to Minas Tirith yet, right? you know? So he's like, even if you could somehow win this battle today, It's like, whatever. He can just send another massive army tomorrow, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go further. Did he see anything else that was not mentioned? What could he possibly have seen? What would Sauron maybe have showed him by now? That he might not even reveal to Gandalf, because he doesn't want to, I don't know, he's pissed and bitter and doesn't want to even give away everything he knows.
Aragorn?
Oh, very good, Clifford. Yes. So he is, so, because Aragorn has revealed himself to Sauron a week ago, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. And that's what, like, made Sauron, like, all right, let's instantly send this army. Let's go. We got to go now. You know, right? We got to get to Minas Tirith, conquer this right now, because there's the king. You know, he's on his way to return, right? So he could reveal that to Denethor, who presumably, since he likes power, wouldn't like that, right? Because he would have to give up the stewardship, the unofficial kingship to the official king, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, what else did he see? Or possibly saw? This one's tricky.
I want to say something with Frodo and Sam, but we're pretty sure that Sauron doesn't know about that, right? So that would be, strike that one off the list.
Hold on. All right, here's the thing. He probably saw Frodo captured in the tower, because if you capture somebody like that, the reports are going to go out, right?
Right.
Because if you look at the timelines, if you look at Appendix B, you can see all the timelines of this. Frodo got captured on March 13th. Where we're at currently is the morning of March 15th. So, like, and if you look at when Faramir was basically mortally wounded, that started on March 13th. And there was, like, you can go, one of the things that you're going to have to do on the second reread is you go through chapters 1 and 2 of book 5 here, and you'll catch references to Denethor using the Palantirs, like, or his Palantir, to see what was like just get more information and stuff. And so, like, when Faramir's first hurt, he goes up into the tower. Like, Beregond actually references it at the end of the chapter. It's like he goes into his tower and there's a pale light, and it's like the pale light is he's looking at the Palantir. And then it's like, well, what's he going to see that's really scaring him even more stiff to go completely off the rails at the end here, like how he is in this chapter? And it's like, yeah, he sees that the inside mission into Mordor has failed. Their guy's captured. The fugitive's captured. Frodo's done. You know, Denethor can put everything together. He's like, Sauron's got it. Like, and these guys don't know it. I know it, you know, but Sauron's got it. Mm-hmm. Right. Whereas we, as the audience, we only know that Frodo's captured. Sam has the ring somewhere.
Okay. So, I mean, yeah, I didn't consider that, but that's a big one. And that would be,
that could be a breaking point. Yeah.
That could be one thing that totally throws off Gandalf, right? If Denethor would have revealed that, that would be a real break in Gandalf's otherwise totally calm demeanor, I would imagine.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I picked up on another thing here.
Okay.
Full disclosure. I am shocked none of my supplementary sources picked up on this. I totally thought they'd have it, but they don't. So this is a Patrick original pickup.
Okay.
In its totality, and I think I'm right. I don't think this is just like, oh, maybe this influenced him. I'm like, nah, this influenced him. All right.
Okay.
So you see, all right, so he said battle is vain, and then in the last quote that we did, and then he says here just vanity. It's just like a one-word sentence. He says vanity. Okay, so you may win today, but you'll lose tomorrow anyways, right? The West has failed. It will crumble. There's no point to fight on. Everything comes crashing down. Mm-hmm. All right, what I instantly thought of, not that I even have much experience with it, but like somehow it's come up enough that it stuck with me, and then I connect to the dots here. This reminds me of one of the randomest books in the Bible, Ecclesiastes. I had another book by Peter Kraft. I use him, like, we use him for a good bit of stuff in this to reference and everything. Mm-hmm. He actually has, like, a book, like, just talking about the Bible and stuff. And so I actually use that to give proper context to this because I couldn't put it in good words. But anyways, I made the connection to Ecclesiastes here. So it's a short book. But this is the book, in Creep's words, that the one that views a world without God. So this is almost like an emo streak of the Jewish rabbis that compiled the Old Testament that they decided to put this one in. It's really weird. It's like anybody, I don't know, if you actually read it and you actually absorb it, because it's kind of hard to absorb, but it's a short book, so I don't know, if you like went at it, you scratch your head, why the hell is this in the Bible? I mean, you know, like it's weird, all right? So it's possibly written by King Solomon, who's the son of King David, and so King David, he's the best king of all time. Solomon, he's originally a pretty good king, but then in his old age he kind of starts to fail, so some people think he wrote it in his old age. And the author basically claims to be the son of David, and so they would assume that's Solomon, but there's a chance that it's actually like, well, no, this is how ancient people wrote to like claim authority or claim wisdom. You would compare yourself to Solomon, kind of. You know, it's like if I wrote something and I said, and I wanted to sound wise, I'm like, I, Socrates, you know, like it's a pseudonym, kind of. So it's probably not Solomon himself. But Kreef goes on, he says, the Bible's only book of philosophy. And by philosophy, he says, philosophy is the wisdom of human reason alone, without any appeal to divine revelation. In this book, God is silent. In the rest of the Bible, God speaks. So this is kind of a really unique kind of book. Because the Bible's pretty big, and this is 6 pages. But this one packs a punch, just as this short chapter packs a punch. So he says, Ecclesiastes asks, and so he almost uses the author just as the name. Ecclesiastes asks, what's the meaning and purpose and hope, reason to live and reason to die? And this question is answered not in this book, but in the rest of the Bible. So it opens up with like vanity. Like vanity is like the whole main theme of this book, right? The first words are basically vanity. And so when they say vanity, they're not talking like the superficial, like look at yourself in the mirror kind of vanity, right? They're talking about vanity equaling vain search, like absence of meaning or purpose, okay? So I'm going to read the opening like poetic verses of this book, and that'll kind of just give you a vibe of what the whole thing's like, okay? So it starts off, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already, in ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to happen among those who come after. All right, what'd you think of that?
Cool.
in a depressing way.
I know. I'm still processing. It's a lot to digest while listening.
Yeah, this is heavy. Yeah,
I know.
Like I said, it's the emo book.
I know. It's pretty interesting. Can you read the last sentence again?
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll read the last couple.
Okay.
What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to happen among those who come after.
This is the version of the vain world with no God. Is that right?
Okay. Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. So going through the world cut off from history and future.
And it's like circular logic, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What has been is going to happen again. You know, the sun sets. Then
There's no potential for anything. Nothing is changing.
Yeah.
Because, the fact that there can be nothing new, it removes all motivation There's like no potential energy. There's no motivation to do anything, to make anything better or anything worse, because you don't expect anything out of the world. Therefore, right. your life becomes totally meaningless.
Yeah, and that's what they mean by the vanity. It's like vain search, absence of meaning and purpose, right? Mm-hmm. Just to reiterate that. So throughout this book, and again, it's a short book, like you can read it in one sitting, but the guy pursues five different lifestyles. One, he pursues wisdom, you know, like to seek out wisdom and everything, mm-hmm. right? Doesn't work. He seeks out pleasure. Doesn't work. That one's more obvious, I guess. Mm-hmm. Wealth and power. Doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Honor and prestige and working for prosperity, just to have like a comfortable life and an mm-hmm. honorable life, right? Doesn't work. He even pursues conventional / kind of letter of the law, surface level, going through the motions kind of like religion, you know? So okay. It's like, I don't know, like your conventional religion, right? But nothing seems to fill this vanity hole in his heart, right? There's a meaning hole in his heart. Nothing can even satisfyingly distract him, even, you know, mm-hmm. that's a big problem with him too. And so he sees throughout this book too, five features that, I don't know about lead to this vanity or highlight this vanity is almost what you would say. When I go through these, take notes, you're going to explain how Denethor relates to these. Well, actually we'll do it together, but connect this with Denethor for me. Okay. So the first one is, blind fate seems to rule no matter what we do. Denethor.
Well, he thinks to the second part, none of his actions can change the doom of Gondor. And also has blind fate in what he has seen in the Palantir as truth.
Right. So what I would kind of think is, you know, didn't he, for the most part... Didn't he and his fathers before him, didn't they rule Gondor pretty well for most of their reigns, for the most part, right? You know, like all the stewards. Yeah. It's like, you know, they did all they could, and then still, look where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
Hell is on our doorstep, right? Mm-hmm. You know, this is like, they got all this fire. They're coming to destroy the city. This is finally like the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so then the next feature of vanity here, all goes down the drain when we die. This is, I don't know. What do you think for Denethor?
The world is ending with him. Once he kills himself, he's viewing it as though the world, the entire West that he views himself as a part of, will cease to exist, and that his own funeral pyre is concurrent and consistent with the funeral pyre of the entire West.
Yeah, yeah. Denethor takes this even beyond himself. It's like, not only am I, when I die, isn't everything's over. It's like my whole kingdom's over, right? Uh-huh. You know, like this illustrious, long, great tradition that stretches all the way back to Numenor. It's like, it ends with me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this isn't fair, right? Mm-hmm. Which, this isn't fair, leads to the third point. Life is full of evil and injustice. Where would Denethor have felt this?
Mm.
/ seen this?
The death of Boromir.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the survival of Faramir. Now, the death of Faramir. And then maybe the armies of Mordor massing at his doorstep, in spite of his attempts to rule well.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say there's no mention of a certainly dead wife. Like, there must have been a wife at some point, but she probably died long ago. You know, his favorite son's dead. Now his other son and heir is mortally wounded. I mean, it's like... Yeah, I mean, any parent rightfully can feel injustice if they're going to die before their kids, you know? The fourth one, time seems to be a cycle that goes nowhere, a merry-go-round without the merry part. So for Denethor, I thought this was kind of hard, but I think he's actually worse. It's like, no, history is just one to twist a certain quote that we've talked about often. History is one... long, agonizing, slow defeat. Mm-hmm. Just extended even worse, you know. Hold on.
One other bit though. Maybe with the cyclical thing is like something about the stewards ruling Gondor, and he's not willing to accept the return.
Good point.
Kings and like the end, the conclusive end of the stewardship reign.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's for him, it's this endless vortex of the stewards are the be all end all of Gondor, kind of.
That's good, Clifford. Yeah, excellent. I totally agree. All right. And then, so then the fifth one is, even God seems to be part of the problem rather than the solution, and mere human experience cannot understand God. I would say Tolkien kind of purposely leaves this dimension out of Lord of the Rings on the surface level, at least, you know. Mm-hmm. But the Numenoreans, I mean, they had a temple to Iluvatar. You know, we saw that in the Fall of Numenor. So potentially Denethor might just feel this and we just don't hear about it. Or, I don't know. Or just, he could somehow relate to that on some level. I don't know. That one's a little bit tougher, but yeah.
Wait, can you read this statement again?
Even God seems to be part of the problem rather than the solution, and mere human experience cannot understand God. Like, yeah, this is a problem that the Ecclesiastes author has. You know?
Yeah. I mean, maybe this is like ties into all the doom that he sees on his doorstep, juxtaposed against what he probably views as the somewhat holy life that he's lived.
Yeah.
You know, something like that. But I agreed that it's left a little bit more open-ended by Tolkien.
Yeah. I do think, like, I thought the Ecclesiastes reference with divinity, I really think this is what Tolkien's talking about. And I don't know, you can tell me, but I don't think that was much of a stretch to
bring up. That's perfect. It was a really great description. And I like the reframing of vanity beyond the way that we typically talk about it.
Right, right. And I thought too, like, Denethor might really be the embodiment of history is one long, but then add final defeat. You know, like Tolkien, he says that line, like, history is one long defeat, but, you know, there's the eucatastrophe moments within it that pushes it off. And then, like, at the very end of time, like, there's the final victory that's forever and for sure. And the eucatastrophes we have now, like, remind us or echo what's coming or foreshadow what's coming, right? Denethor doesn't believe that part at all. You know, it's like, no,
it's like Gandalf is the catastrophe in Denethor's view of, or Denethor is just viewing the long defeat.
Right. To restate, Denethor says, "The West has failed. It is time for all to depart who would not be slaves."
"Such counsels will make the enemy's victory certain indeed," said Gandalf.
"Hope on, then," laughed Denethor. "But I do not know thee, Mithrandir. Thy hope is to rule in thy stead, to stand behind thy throne, north, south, or west. I have read thy mind and its policies. Do I not know that you command this halfling here to keep silent, that you brought him hither to be a spy within my very chamber? And yet in our speech together I have learned the names and purposes of all thy companions. So, with the left hand thou wouldest use me for a little while as a shield against Mordor, and with the right bring up this ranger of the north to supplant me. But I say to thee, Gandalf Mithrandir, I will not be thy tool. I am the steward of the House of Anarion. I will not step down to be the dotard chamberlain of an upstart. Even were his claim proved to me, still he comes but of the line of Isildur. I will not bow to such a one, last of a ragged house, long bereft of lordship and dignity."
"What then would you have," said Gandalf, "if your will could have its way?"
"I would have things as they were in all the days of my life," answered Denethor, "and in the days of my long fathers before me, to be the lord of the city in peace, and leave my chair to a son after me, who would be his own master and no wizard's pupil. If doom denies this to me, then I will have naught, neither life diminished, nor love halved, nor honor abated."
"To me it would not seem that a steward who faithfully surrenders his charge is diminished in love or in honor," said Gandalf. "And at the least, you shall not rob your son of his choice while his death is still in doubt." At those words, Denethor's eyes flamed again, and taking the stone under his arm, he drew a knife and strode towards the bier. But Baragon sprang forward and set himself before Faramir.
"So," cried Denethor, "thou hast already stolen half my son's love. Now thou stealest the hearts of my knights also, so that they rob me wholly of my son at last. But in this at least thou shalt not defy my will, to rule my own end." "Come hither," he cried to his servants. "Come if you are not all recreant." Then two of them ran up the steps to him. Swiftly, he snatched a torch from the hand of one and sprang back into the house. Before Gandalf could hinder him, he thrust his brand amid the fuel, and at once it crackled and roared into flame. Then Denethor leaped upon the table, and standing up, wreathed in fire and smoke, he took up the staff of his stewardship that lay at his feet and broke it on his knee. Casting the pieces into the blaze, he bowed and laid himself on the table, clasping the plantyr with both hands upon his breast. And it is said that ever after, if any man looked in that stone, unless he had a great strength of will to turn it to other purpose, he saw only two aged hands withering in flame. Gandalf, in his grief and horror, turned his face away and closed the door. For a while he stood in thought, silent upon the threshold, while those outside heard the greedy roaring of the fire within. And then Denethor gave a great cry, and afterwards spoke no more, nor was ever again seen by mortal men.
"So passes Denethor, son of Ecthelion," said Gandalf. Then he turned to Barragond and the Lord's servants that stood there aghast. "And so pass also the days of Gondor that you have known. For good or evil, they are ended. Ill deeds have been done here. But let now all enmity that lies between you be put away, for it was contrived by the enemy and works his will. You have been caught in a net of warring lies that you did not weave. But think, you servants of the Lord, blind in your obedience, that but for the treason of Barragond, Faramir, captain of the White Tower, would also now be burned."
All right, so that was the big climax, sad climax. What do we think? A lot there.
I mean, it is ultimately the ending that Denethor carved out for himself, and the only victory is that Faramir was spared.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way to see it. It's a shame that Denethor set himself on fire, but it is ultimately the culmination of what he wanted.
Right? Well, yeah.
What he believed in himself.
And why? Why?
Because of the whole vanity thing we just discussed, right? Like, he saw himself as the be-all, end-all of everything. And once he ceased to believe in anything beyond himself, he had no reason to go on living. So he thought that his kind of his own self-sacrifice would be the culmination of everything that he believed in. It's just that.
Yeah. So what did he want? He wanted just peace and quiet, things to go on as normal, how he had always lived, right? And what was he going to get? That was over no matter what. Because even if they somehow win this battle, which he doesn't think they will, who's coming? Aragorn. You know, and he's going to have to give up his stewardship, right? This is the heir, and like, there's probably not going to be a way out of it, even if I don't believe his claim, right? You know, no matter what, his world's changed. And then Gandalf, after Faramir dies, Gandalf actually says it to the people. He says, "And so passes also the days of Gondor that you have known. For good or evil, they are ended," right? You know, so it's like, this is definitively, we're entering some sort of new age, basically, right?
And I also thought Denethor's words specifically tied directly back to your quoting of Ecclesiastes, like he's literally saying, like, "I just wanted to go back to how it always was. Like, I want a world that's unchanging and just repeating itself again and again.
Yeah.
And I don't, like, all of this change happening around is like things that I didn't wish or will. I just want stasis. And instead there's lack of stasis, and he's
status quo. Exactly. Right. Well, so it's kind of weird. The Ecclesiastes writer kind of doesn't like that, but Denethor does because he's on top.
Exactly.
He's like the commander of the greatest nation in the world, right? But okay, so let's start going off the charts, comparing everything. All right, ready? We're just going to compare left and right. This is going to be rapid fire stuff. Okay, so compared to somebody else who stupidly looked in a plantyr, who am I thinking of that's not Pippin?
Denethor? Or Saruman? No,
besides Denethor. Yeah, Saruman. All right. So Saruman, when he was looking at this thing, he ended up becoming evil, right? And what he ended up trying to do was, like, modernize and kind of keep up with the times. You know, famously, he industrializes, right? You know, like, Tolkien's picking up on that kind of stuff. Denethor's like, it's weird. He has the opposite, like, arch-conservative, like, status quo, like what we were saying. I mean, that's kind of just, that's funny in itself. That's, like, the two different opposite responses, right?
That's a great point. Saruman tried to adapt himself, and in his adaptation was basically bent to evil means, whereas Denethor was extraordinarily stubborn, and in his stubbornness was turned against the good things that could change.
Yeah, so we'll mention that we're going to come back to that. But first, I want to compare him to somebody else. The obvious person we're supposed to, like, Token's trying to beat you over the head to compare him to is who else in this chapter, or in the chapter before? Like, who is Denethor's, to use a literary term, foil? There's actually a couple, but who's, Théoden? Like, the real main one? Yeah, Théoden. They're probably the same age. They literally die at about the exact same time, probably. Yeah. I mean, it might be, you know, a couple minutes off or so, but
and
it's
probably
like
leaders of adjacent kingdoms,
right? Kingdoms, you know, they both have the Hobbit in their service. They both have sons that have died. You know, it's like they're similar ages and everything, right? Yeah, so
long,
I mean,
history,
there's like
going back together, yeah,
right? All sorts of comparisons. So, you know, Théoden, even though he's an old man, he had armed himself for war. Denethor had actually also armed himself for war in the last chapter. Remember when he was, like, sleeping in his armor for years? Right. That really weird reference. And what now at the end, how did it end? Théoden, he was slain in battle heroically, right? And it was awesome. He takes the MVP, or most improved award of the podcast, in my opinion. You know, like, he's been such a great character to learn about, right? Whereas Denethor, you know, he does nothing whatsoever to defend the city. Mm-hmm. And then
and if anything, actively tries to sabotage it.
Right, right. Yeah. And think about it, too. Let's go further. When the Rohirrim were preparing to charge in, Merry literally has lines that say, he looked at Théoden and he saw a great weight and horror and doubt before the charge. And Merry thinks he could just slink away, hide in the hills for the rest of his days, right? And then Grond, the battering ram, it bursts open the gates of Minas Tirith. The boom causes Théoden to spring up, and he does the arise, arise, riders of Théoden speech, you know, he goes at it, right? And what is Denethor doing at that very moment? He's literally doing his best attempt to slink away to hide in the hills. He's at the very top of this hill city, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and he's like, you know, in a chamber corner out of the way. Like, he's doing everything he could to, like, fulfill this, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the ironies of this whole chapter, it's like a movie scene, you know, where, like, the characters are kind of running in and out of one shot, but they're not, and they're looking for each other, but they're not finding each other, but the audience is seeing what's happening. Right. You know, like, this chapter is, like, the culmination of that for the past four chapters. Right. Or five, just seven chapters. I don't even know. It might be all seven chapters, really, of this book five, right? Let's see. Tom Shippey has, like, this really good passage that I want to read, because it was, I don't know, it was just phenomenal. It's, I got a lot of phenomenal passes just to read tonight, I guess. But okay, so he says, one point surely is the difference between Théoden and Denethor over all their similarities. Denethor is cleverer than Théoden, knows more, is more civilized, and perhaps more intelligent, but he is not wiser. He does not understand about luck. He looks too far into the future and misinterprets what he sees. Above all, he trusts to his own chain of logic. What he sees in the future is, in the first place, defeat. But even if that were to be avoided, change. He has worked out who Strider is and sees that victory would mean being supplanted as steward by the return of the king. But he is not prepared to accept any change at all. When Gandalf asks him almost at the last moment what he wants, he says, I would have things as they were in all the days of my life and in the days of my long fathers before me. And if that is not possible, if doom denies this to me, then I will have naught, neither life diminished, nor love have, nor honor abated, right? I mean, all right, so what do you think of that? I mean, it's kind of like a rehash of what we said, but Shippey extends it further, though, and he says, to have nothing, by the time of the publishing of Lord of the Rings, that was an available option to political world leaders, you know? so, right? Because when was Lord of the Rings published?
Unpack that a little bit. What do you mean?
Well, when was Lord of the Rings published?
40.
Wrong. Come on, Clifford. What? It was written in the 40s. When was it published?
Oh, okay. What, 52 or something?
Yeah, 54.
54? Okay.
All right. What existed by 1954?
The Soviet Union?
That existed since 1917. Come on. Cutting edge technology of the time.
Oh, the nuclear bombs.
Right. So. Okay. So. Now we were in the Cold War, nuclear war, right? Uh-huh. So if you want applicability, the West has failed. Théoden kind of represents the major late 20th century fear leaders with the death wish, according to Shippey, you know, who have given up on conventional weapons. And Shippey points out, he says, one sees how fortunate it is that Denethor did not gain control of the ring. Right? You know, because it's like, because people have compared the ring to the nuclear bomb and stuff, and it's like Tolkien always thought, like, I hate this. This is not an allegory, right? It's like the applicability stuff, and it's like, yeah, that is applicable. Like, in that situation, if they had, or if Denethor got it, then it's like, it would be like he had an atomic bomb in his hand and he would just have mutual destruction for everybody. Like, he would be, let's launch it, right?
Yeah, it's like, ultimately, Denethor, his most dangerous moment is that he's going to kill Faramir and sabotage the defense of his own city.
Right.
And Gandalf, at least so far, is able to avert both of those.
Yeah.
But had Denethor had anything, it could be much worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. But the ironies here continue to stack up. So we've already seen, like, with the Plantyr, Sauron was directly influencing Denethor, right? That's clear, you know, to you, everybody, right? Okay. Okay. What have we brought up a number of times already in the show? Let's go back. Let's go back to Shakespeare. Which play specifically? Take a guess.
Help me out.
Or Macbeth.
Macbeth. Okay. Yeah. We've talked about Macbeth multiple times.
Okay. All right, so famously, like, the famous start of Macbeth is like it's the witches with the double toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble, right? Okay, so like that's where that comes from, like all those like chants and stuff. And so they do that when they're saying prophecies, right? And so the play starts off, or early in the play, Macbeth hears one of their prophecies, and it says, among other things, that he's going to be king. And so then what happens? All of the prophecies come true. Some come about on their own. Others, like becoming king, Macbeth ends up kind of working for. And he makes these prophecies. Well, and so like the key is he starts working for it and makes these prophecies come true only because he ever heard the prophecy itself, right? He didn't actually have these ideas beforehand. And what is like work for it to become king? It means murder the current king is the very first step, and then murder a bunch of other people too. So it's like, obviously that's not the right way to become king. And so all over this chapter and in Lord of the Rings in general, Tolkien kind of takes Shakespeare's prophecies like a step further. Shippey says, he plays with a question Shakespeare doesn't actually ask, whether these events would have come true if Macbeth had not tried to make them come true. Maybe Macbeth still would have become like king, you know, even without working for it, aka murdering people. You know, like maybe the prophecy would just have come true. Like, Shakespeare didn't kind of try to figure that out. We've already seen this in Lord of the Rings, the Mirror of Galadriel. She was predicting things for Frodo and Sam. We remember that, right? And so, like, you know, Frodo and Sam, they kind of just continue on their mission, and TBD if all the things that transpired in that mirror are going to come true. At least one has already come true. Like, because Sam had a vision that he was holding Frodo dead in a mountain pass. And so we saw that, right? At the end of book four. So that's one. Where else have we seen this in Lord of the Rings?
Just in terms of prophecy.
It's more recent. Yeah, it's more recent too. Not explicit prophecy, just kind of foreshadowing. You know what I'm talking about. Kind of just vague stuff like.
Well, I was thinking of the prophecy that the Gondorians have about the return of the king.
Oh, that's a good one, right?
That's more specifically a prophecy, but and a little bit further back. More recently, don't we kind of have, we've got Aragorn going through Paths of the Dead as a little bit
so
of...
So he was following a prophecy from Gandalf, and he almost used that one to, like, his best effect. So what I was thinking of was Pippin inadvertently and Aragorn purposely, they used the Plantyr to foreshadow things to Sauron himself.
Okay.
You know, like Sauron sees, like, oh, a hobbit spy is captured by Saruman, but, like, Pippin's not doing that on purpose. Whereas Aragorn's like, hey, I exist. I'm coming. Look at this, you know? And so then Sauron starts his plan. And so Sauron actually, like, he's fooled by this, like, you know, because when he sees Aragorn, he sends his army out sooner than expected. And currently that's allowed Frodo and Sam to get to the border of Mordor easier because there's less guards. And then the army at Minas Tirith is smaller than originally intended and has now been defeated. Like, we've seen that, right? Okay, so, like, so that was a misstep on Sauron's part. Like, he was falling for this. Even that, you know, and is this, like, a prophecy? I don't know, but it's, like, you know, like, the kind of magic witches kind of stuff, like, what we're saying in Macbeth, right? So Sauron himself also does this prophecy foreshadowing stuff, obviously, to Saruman and Denethor in the same way, using the Plantyr, right? Like, they see exactly what he wants them to see, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's so bad to the point where we kind of have to ask, like, if they never used these Plantyrs, would they have actually fallen? You know, like maybe Saruman and Denethor would still be good guys if they did not use these things, mm-hmm. right? Like, Denethor, if he didn't look into these Plantyr, just in these final days alone, it's very, very unlikely he commits suicide in this situation. Would you agree or disagree?
I think I would agree that it's unlikely he commits suicide.
I mean, he still wouldn't be happy that Aragorn's showing up.
Yeah, I think with both of them, though, it's like the trajectory of their accumulation of power and what they thought about their own wisdom and strength and everything was ultimately, that was like the break.
Yeah, but that's...
And the Palantir was then like a highway to really accelerate that destruction process. But I feel like that was like, they hit that point and that was like, it flicked a switch and they entered into a self-destructive pattern, and the Palantir just made it a lot easier, you know?
Okay.
In other words, I kind of feel like they were corrupted without the Palantir, and by the time they looked at the Palantir, they maybe didn't feel it or outwardly exhibit anything, but they were already kind of corrupted by their own actions and behavior. And
I think I agree, but it's like, it's their choice to look into the Palantir, and then because of their motivations are already set, then that kind of seals their fate.
Yeah. Or maybe I should say, like, maybe corrupted is the wrong word, but like when they, it's like they're giving into temptation to look into it, and then they're being corrupted from there.
It's not even like, I think it's a little bit worse than like giving into temptation, because it's something that they just firmly knew not to do.
Right.
Like, but they did it to like look for knowledge, or because they finally, maybe they did cave for temptation. I don't know. I'm going.
But yeah, it's like they spent a long enough time convincing themselves they weren't giving into temptation, but that they were instead powerful enough to deal with it.
Yeah. So,
They convinced themselves that the circumstances had changed when they really hadn't. And that was like meant that they thought more highly of themselves than they should have. I don't know. Anyways.
Yeah. Well, so here's kind of like a crucial difference that I was picking up on. And maybe this isn't quite true, because the Aragorn taking the paths of the dead, like that was clearly prophesied, mm-hmm. and he was relying on prophecies when he did that. But still, I still would say there's a difference, even though he was kind of like relying on a prophecy. I don't know, the prophecies, they don't seem to affect the good characters from carrying on with their duty. Whether it's going to be true or not doesn't exactly matter to them. Like, that's almost even, I think that's even the case with Aragorn when he takes the paths of the dead. It's like, this is like the only way, you know, like my duty is to defend the city, and they need a bigger army than what they have right now. Like, there's no other way about it. Like, I just have to go for this, and I don't know. We can talk about Aragorn in a second a little bit more. Versus the bad characters here, and by the bad characters, I'm saying Denethor, and I'm saying Saruman, and I'm saying Sauron himself, obviously. They do seem to see some sort of prophecy, and then their actions to either ensure that it comes true or to prevent it, or in Theoden's case, almost just to, like, succumb to it, leads to that prophecy coming true. Even though it might... or probably wouldn't have happened if they did not act on it. You know, like, if they hadn't seen the prophecy and they didn't act on it, there's a very good chance that, like, that prophecy never comes true. But they saw it, and then they act on it. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of happens in Star Wars 3, like Revenge of the Sith. Like, Anakin has dreams that Padme is going to die in childbirth.
Mm-hmm.
And if he didn't have those dreams, then maybe he wouldn't have sought out the dark side to try to prevent it. And then he seeks out the dark side, and then that's what kills her.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, I didn't really like that movie, but...
That's a good comparison.
Yeah. Off the top of my head, I guess, but I don't know. What do you think?
The Macbeth seems like...
That's probably a better comparison.
Yeah, probably the best example for Tolkien.
Yeah. I don't know. How do you feel about these prophecies, though? Like, you think, like, it's almost like a rule. Like Tolkien's basically questioning the rule. Like, Shakespeare just kind of lays out the rule implicitly, like, hey, all of these things are going to come true,
mm-hmm.
whether the characters work for him or not. Tolkien's mm-hmm. like questioning, maybe this stuff's not going to come true, but then
right.
the character...
It's like he's woven in the free will of the
yep.
characters into their own demise or their own success. which is like a, it's a, I think it's very subtle and a little bit tricky, but it's like, yeah, I guess avoiding what you were just saying about Shakespeare, like that it's preordained and it's going to happen. Instead, there's free will, but it's like the part of that free will is the prophecy is still, it's not just a description. It's like an active player in the plot, you know?
Yeah.
It has consequences. It's not just a future description.
Right. All right. So then now also let's add on here just more stuff. So of course Denethor has no idea what's going on outside of his own little world, which now revolves around a tomb, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, Rohan has come, and Théoden, a personal ally to Denethor, who is like, you know, Théoden was literally saying like, "Ah, Denethor has no idea we're coming, right? You know, on the way." Mm-hmm. He has heroically died for Denethor, defending Denethor's city, right? And Denethor doesn't, he probably doesn't know that Aragorn's in the ships coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And he definitely does not know the status of Frodo in the tower, and he has no idea that Sam's the one that actually has the ring, right? So he doesn't know that their mission is, like, potentially still intact into Mordor, right? Mm-hmm. He has no idea about any of this. So Denethor is, like, he's the opposite to Théoden, and then he's, like, the exact opposite to Aragorn, in my opinion, you know? Because Aragorn, like, Aragorn's going to be his successor, counterpart, mm-hmm. or whatnot, you know? And, like, he's the exact opposite to Gandalf, obviously, too, who's been having the confrontation with all chapter, right? So, like, in that second chapter, though, of this book, the Paths of the Dead chapter, Aragorn was, like, the definitely not nihilist Ecclesiastes, right? You know, it's like he trusted in providence, the divine plan. Like, he did not fully understand what was going on. Like, he had those prophecies, like, I don't know, these prophecies seem like maybe it'll work, and it kind of has to work because this is the only hope, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm just gonna hope for the, I'm gonna follow it, and I'm literally gonna hope for the best, right? Mm-hmm. And that was all his motivation to do the whole thing, right? And then by providence, it beautifully all comes together in, like, the fairy tale kind of you catastrophe moment where he saves the city at the end, right? He's the last one to show up. They win the battle. It takes all day to win it still, but, like, they win the battle. Denethor, he's the exact opposite. He trusted himself and his knowledge only, which was really just Sauron's propaganda, right? The TV, you know? Like, mm-hmm. And then that led him to getting himself killed and others killed and no hope of any outcome that he'd be satisfied with because, you know, he didn't want to bow down to Aragorn, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tom Shippey has one last really good passage that I want to read because it just, like, kind of ties a bow on most of the stuff because we're actually finally almost done. So it says, "There are still several things one cannot say. For instance, that Saruman's treachery was accordingly a good thing, or that the rescue of Minas Tirith is a reward for Aragorn's persistence. After all, if Saruman had stayed loyal, things might have ended better. If Aragorn had abandoned the chase, Merry and Pippin would have stirred up Fangorn just the same. What one can be absolutely sure about is that giving up does the other side's work for them, and ruins all their own possible futures and other people's as well. The despair of Denethor killed Théoden, as predicted by Gandalf. While persistence offers no guarantees, it does give luck a chance to operate." And by luck, we're talking about providence, you know. "Through unknown allies or unknown weaknesses in the opposition. As a working theory, this is impregnable, whether considered skeptically or superstitiously. To it, the interlacements contribute a recognizable attitude towards reality. Events in the world, they say, appear chaotic and unplanned, appear so all but unmistakably. But however strong that impression is, it is a subjective one found on the inevitable limited view of any individual. If individuals could see more widely, as we can, by virtue of the narrative structure of The Lord of the Rings, they would realize that events have a cause and effect logic, though there are so many causes that perhaps no one but God can ever see them all at once. The world is a Persian carpet, then, and we are ants lumbering from one thread to the other and observing that there is no pattern in the colors. That is why one of Gandalf's favorite sayings is, even the wisest cannot see all ends, and why he often demonstrates its truth himself." All right, this is a bit of a long quote, but what do you think?
I have no pre-formulated thoughts.
So. Okay, fair enough. I mean, it's really the intricacy of the stories lining up together, like, that's fun in itself. Mm-hmm. But what's the broader point? Because it's like, all right, we don't the individual characters themselves only see their storyline and they don't understand how it fits in the big picture, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when you draw it together and you read Lord of the Rings, you do see how it fits in the big picture. And it's like that Persian rug. So like that's a famous analogy for like God's providence. Is like Persian rugs are super elaborate and ornate,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's got all sorts of stitches, especially if you look at like the backside of it. It doesn't look like anything, right? And so it's almost like the little threads of it, or even just the whole backside. Maybe that's what humans see, right? But then the...
Or individuals see.
Right.
So, yeah.
But then the divine author or artist of divine providence, what does he see? He sees the full Persian rug on the front, displayed in all its glory, perfect, you know, everything fits together in harmony, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so is it entertaining to kind of get the storylines from different perspectives all the time, and it's like, you know, just building suspense and everything? Yeah, that's one reason, but then it's also like this additional, deeper reason, you know, and that's why we've had this for basically like since the end of Fellowship of the Ring. It's just been different right. storylines.
Multiple kinda. Threads weaving in and yeah. out of each other.
Right, and it's still going on with Frodo and Sam in the East, you know, in mm-hmm. Mordor at this mm-hmm. point, right? And so, you know, Aragorn... He kind of was Aragorn though, like Aragorn and Gandalf, they're kind of the difference. Like they are aware of this. Denethor kind of rejects this by this point, just like the author of Ecclesiastes probably rejected that too, you know, and that's mm-hmm. why he wrote that book.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Gandalf and Aragorn was like, we got to use this like, because this is our only hope anyways. It's like, we got to really just lean into this and just like trust it. And Gandalf, I mean, that's entirely what he's been doing since like Bag End chapter mm-hmm. 2, you know, when he's explaining this stuff to Frodo.
I guess it's every time we come across a negative twist in the story, I think we come back to some idea like this.
Yeah.
That there is like the kind of the larger narrative or some redeeming factor, which is kind of interesting. I think it's you're explaining it well. It's not like we're kind of like apologizing for the negative thing that happens or like talking around it, but it does. Yeah, it fits into the broader context of the story in a very particular way.
Well, even the negative, like, kind of, they're usually, at least in this story, they're usually pretty decently obviously, like, free will can right. even cause, like, the negatives. But even that's, like, taken up into the story, into the, like, the kind of perfect Persian carpet, I guess,
mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like Denethor's death, with all that in mind, is, like, it's part of the larger woven narrative, and it is ultimately he went out the way that he wanted to go out, even after Gandalf explained like why it was wrong and he shouldn't do it. And so we agree with Gandalf, but we see the larger narrative. Do you feel like did Denethor fulfill his character properly?
Yeah, I would say so. Yes, and that almost actually, like, it kind of transitions into, like, my last big point for tonight. Okay. So, from our literal armchairs, right, we're all reading this, right? Usually it's almost in an armchair, right? Okay, so Denethor comes off as really stupid to us, right?
Right.
Like he did, and he did act stupidly.
Yeah.
But I think he did fulfill his character. And before we just like write him off as like idiot, bad end, you know, lame, mm-hmm. like just dumb. It's like he's a warning, obviously, you know. Like that, like but before I even say that, it's like, can't we all relate to that, right? Especially in sort of high pressure situations. And what do we say at the top of this, like, you know, a great story shows a conflict within somebody, you know? And
right,
so it's like,
right.
there's always that danger that, you know, this could be us. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, all right, can we not relate to that? Right. Even though he was so stupid, haven't we all been stupid like that? Haven't, you know, isn't this just like, isn't this like a great warning to us? You know, like this character clearly fulfilled his end and it was a bad, tragic end, just like Macbeth was a tragedy. That's why it's like a famous story, is because it's like, yes, you can learn from it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you can learn from it, it's like, isn't that a major reason to study great literature, just period? You know, like it's entertaining, right? Mm-hmm. But then it's like, why do you study it? Why do you come back to it? It's because it's like, they have truths to teach us, you know, like in a very artistic, entertaining way, right? You know, like mm-hmm. like the best stories, that is like the facts, right? So this is why, like, I intentionally said, all right, we're not gonna, I could probably edit stuff out of this chapter and just like cut it down, trim this one down. Mm-hmm. But like, I actively said, let's not do that so that we can put this on display. Right. Like, you know, this chapter is 8 pages, you know, and now we've talked about it for like 90 minutes. Uh-huh. And so, you know, like historically, like this is why the great texts, you know, were studied, like what we're doing, you know, in the liberal arts, like at a university and stuff, right? It's mm-hmm. like you learn these truths because it makes someone wiser, right? And when you become wise, we are liberated, right? Liberal arts, liberated from our base passions or even creature comforts, you know, almost play on like Hobbit Bilbo and stuff, or like, mm-hmm. you know, when we read this, because it's those passions and the creature comforts that enslave us, right? You know, like people have said, like, discipline sets you free. That's pretty close, because wise people are usually wisely disciplined, right? Mm. And then disciplined people, you know, through their discipline, they gain more wisdom, right? But it's mm-hmm. really like wisdom sets you free. Mm. Or I don't know. That's my opinion. And that was the opinion of lots of ancients, and especially the medieval people that created universities. Like that is where they got the idea. It's like wisdom mm. sets you free. That's the liberal arts. That's how you're liberated.
The motto of the University of Texas that I walked past so many times when I was in school is, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free."
Yes, correct, Clifford.
So almost word for word what you just said.
Yeah, very cool.
Well, to tie it back to what you were saying, I agree. It's important to, yeah, he has a resonant character because you still relate to him, even though he seems kind of like a bad guy from the outset, in my opinion. As soon as we meet him. And we watch him do stupid, mean-spirited things, but there's still, we can still relate to him.
Yeah, I mean, but and you feel bad for him too. Like you don't like him, but you do feel right. bad for him, because it's like, ah, look, you know, his favorite son died. Now his heir is dying. He's confused. He's crazy. He's upset. He's distraught. And now, and it's the end of his kingdom. You know, like 3,000 years of history on his shoulders, and he's the one that's going to let everybody down. I mean, it's like, you know, he didn't rise to the challenge at all. It sucks, but like, still, I mean, yeah. And he was cowardly at the end, but it's, and you don't weep for him because he was cowardly, but you just say, I don't know. I kind of get it. As we said, he's a warning. Plot wise, I guess it would be weird if you were somehow to live and then welcome Aragorn. You know, it could be redemptive though, and it's like sad that he didn't have that redemptive moment, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I don't know. That's kind of how I'd roundabout long way of saying. I don't know. I think this was the right. This was the fulfillment of his character, and it was a sad fulfillment.
Right.
Just like Saruman's was.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
Because Saruman, he could have been hand in hand with Gandalf. Helping take down Sauron. I don't know. Then there's the rest of the chapter wrap up. What did you read?
I read right near the end.
Did you?
Yeah.
Shall we do your thing now? Because, I mean, Baragon
sure.
feels
I think
bad.
I think it'll be a pretty... Yeah. It was a kind of a summary piece. They looked at Gandalf, and for a while, he was silent. At last he spoke. "My friends," he said, "and all you people of this city and of the western lands... Things of great sorrow and renown have come to pass. Shall we weep or be glad? Beyond hope, the captain of our foes has been destroyed, and you have heard the echo of his last despair. But he has not gone without woe or bitter loss, and that I might have averted but for the madness of Denethor. So long has the reach of our enemy become. Alas, but now I perceive how his will was able to enter into the very heart of the city. Though the stewards deemed that it was a secret kept only by themselves, long ago I guessed that here in the White Tower... One at least of the 7 seeing stones was preserved. In the days of his wisdom, Denethor would not presume to use it to challenge Sauron, knowing the limits of his own strength. But his wisdom failed, and I fear that as the peril of his realm grew, he looked in the stone and was deceived, far too often, I guess, since Boromir departed. He was too great to be subdued to the will of the Dark Power. He saw, nonetheless, only those things which that power permitted him to see. The knowledge which he obtained was, doubtless, often of service to him. Yet the vision of the great might of Mordor was shown to him, fed the despair of his heart until it overthrew his mind."
Clifford, well done.
Thank you, thank you.
Yeah, really wrapped it up too. Excellent, excellent. Yeah, so I mean, I don't know. Baragon felt bad that he had to kill some of the Gondor soldiers. What else? Faramir, they took him to the Houses of the Healing, so that sounds like the hospital. They heard the shriek from the Witch King being killed. You know, Gandalf connects all the dots that you read. And yeah, I mean, lays out how Denethor was corrupted by the Palantir. And that's kind of how the chapter ends.
Do you feel like this is like a, it's like a cleansing? Or it is, I guess, the end of Gondor as we've known it, is this chapter. Yeah. It feels kind of like the end is a really like conclusive, more conclusive of an ending than we often get from these chapters. Like there's kind of a moment of cleansing almost where Gandalf is like, a new chapter is starting now.
Well, we kind of got to see what happens next, but I get your feeling. I would say I kind of agree. Like there was some finality to this and it was almost eye-openingly real, you know? Mm-hmm. Like this wasn't like the fairy tale kind of thing from the last chapter, right?
Right.
But I would say, I'm just going to answer your question with the question because I don't really know besides what I just said for your answer.
Okay.
I would say, do you think this chapter should have been before the last chapter? Or do you think it was right to come after the last chapter? Because in the last chapter, it starts with Théoden dying. Then they get they kill the Nazgûl. And then Éomer's charging, thinking he's going to die. And then Aragorn shows up at the end. And then there's the funeral song, right? So that chapter almost kind of had a bit of finality to it, too.
Yeah,
and this, true. So now this chapter, it referenced that the Witch King is clearly killed. But it doesn't say how. It doesn't say who. And it has no idea that besides that Denethor said it, they don't really know that the ships are coming up. And they definitely don't know that Aragorn's on the ships.
Right.
So should he, even if he changes, like, you know, the Witch King's, like, just leave in the shriek line and don't have Gandalf connect the dots that the Witch King's dead. Like, take that line out.
Uh-huh.
Would you put it before the other chapter?
I don't think so.
Really?
The other one, like, the momentum and the energy of the battle, I think, is so important. And you get the end of the battle, and then we pivot. Whereas if this went before, I think it would throw off the battle a little bit, even if it would be slightly better for this chapter.
You think? Because I thought this chapter started off with, like, no suspense at all. Like, it was lame, no suspense at all. And then, like, now I guess we do really get to, like what you were saying, this really is kind of final. We get to really not hold our breath anymore. Like, you know, take, like, let go, right? You know, like, now the battle's really, really over because we know we have every single loose end tied up right now. You know, like, mm-hmm. And besides Frodo and Sam, every single storyline has now converged, right? Now we're caught up at every single point. But I think, you know, the fifth chapter ends with Théoden giving the speech and then the charge in, right? And then the sixth chapter starts exactly with him, exactly where it left off. Could you have put this chapter in with Pippin? Because this chapter starts off where the fourth chapter left off, where Gandalf was at the gate against the Black Rider. So this could have, like, you know, started the sixth chapter and, like, put suspense there. And then it's like, you know, they save Faramir, but there's still the suspense of the whole chapter because it's like, well, what's going on downstairs? Like, we don't know. Mm-hmm. But then, I don't know, I would actually say, I think you could have carried the suspense this whole chapter and then it would end and there wouldn't be like a let go of the breath, but then there's still suspense, like what's going on downstairs, but clearly nothing's come up, but what's going on? So I'd almost say that besides that, it's kind of good that it was after this chapter because now all of the situational irony that we've been talking about is laid bare. And we can openly discuss it without spoiling anything, you know? Uh-huh. And so that's almost an irony in itself, a last irony of all the ironies that we've described on top of it. Like, he got this right. So now people, when they're doing their book clubs, they can discuss this openly without, and they don't have to get it on the second reread. You can get it on the first reread or first read, you know? I don't know. That was my thought.
Okay. I buy it. I'm not opposed to what you're saying. I do think, like, the alternation of the storylines and then the momentum of the battle feels like it's, I have a hard time seeing it another way, but You make strong points.
I agree with that too, but I think it's like, I think we could sacrifice a little bit of the epic end of chapter 5, jumping straight into chapter 6. You could jump back straight to chapter 6. I think it would be easier than like what you were, maybe even Token was thinking, but I don't know. Maybe that's just me. Because I would get pumped as soon as I see Théoden charging in anywhere. Yeah, and then Aragorn coming. It's like, that was the real thing. It's like, they put the more real downer end at the very end, as opposed to the bow on top, Aragorn showing up, and fairy tale end, you know? Like, that's my main qualm, I guess.
Okay.
But yeah, you could go either way, and maybe for a first read through, it maybe makes sense to put this here, because this like really does help lay out everything. Like, Gandalf's literally connecting dots at the end. Or I guess not literally, but he's explicitly connecting dots at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I think this is good. I think it was more than enough. yeah, only a couple more chapters to go. Book 5 now.
Exciting.
Yeah. Anything else?
No.
All right. Yeah, let's leave it here then. Sweet. Yeah. We are recording the ending to this long Denethor chapter, the very short chapter in the book, long in the podcast. Mm. Surprise, surprise.
Loaded with meaning.
Yeah, couldn't help ourselves. I couldn't help myself, and Clifford was dragged. All right. Tonight, if anybody's wondering, we are actually recording a certain book 6, chapter 3 chapter. So...
If those numbers mean anything to you.
Yeah. We probably don't have a lot of time to spend on this exit outro. So, Clifford, I hope you've been good.
I have been indeed. And you, Patrick?
I have been good as well. But there's no reason to get into that because we have so much to do right after this.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, y'all.